Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's launch right into it. So we're going to talk about CRISPR. CRISPR is one of the most intriguing technologies to be invented in this century. In fact, the inventors already won the Nobel Prize, first women in chemistry, I might add. And that's because this has, it's nothing short of a major game changer. It allows for targeted cut and paste of human, bacterial, any kind of DNA. See, all life on this planet, even unlife like viruses, can be addressed with CRISPR. So far there have been some very interesting studies, lots of animals with interesting characteristics. There's talk of maybe eradicating or making mosquitoes infertile so that they can't spread malaria anymore, but those are far in the future. This just happened, just announced in the New England Journal of Medicine. Two separate research groups, one using CRISPR, one using a related technology, which is, ironically enough, very similar to the technology of the AstraZeneca Oxford COVID vaccine. And we'll come back around to that in a moment. Both of them were looking at a common disease called sickle cell anemia and another not so uncommon disease called beta thalassemia. Each year, 300,000 people are diagnosed with sickle cell anemia. 60,000 are diagnosed with beta thalassemia. And it's both of these are caused by a different mutation on the gene for the beta subunit of hemoglobin. In the case of sickle cell, the beta subunit has a single amino acid substitution that affects its structural stability, really. Now, proteins, as you must remember, come out as a chain, but because the protein out of that ribosome, they get spit out as a long chain of amino acids, but they don't stay a long chain because they carry charge on their surfaces, little positive and negative charges that act like magnets and twist this emerging protein into a very distinct shape. And the shape, this is form follows function at its ultimate source. The shape determines how well that protein's going to do its job, whether it's going to be more or less stable, or whether it's going to have a fatal flaw, like the sickle cell hemoglobin. In conditions of low pH, that is to say, when there's a little acid in the blood, the hemoglobin will actually bend out of shape, losing its nice globular form, which holds a molecule of oxygen in the center of a sort of a catcher's mitt shape, if you will, losing that and turning into a spiky thing, which literally breaks open the red blood cells, which are full of hemoglobin, and suddenly they're full of those little stars that 007 spits out of the back of his car when he's being chased by the bad guys. Not so great. Well, very painful, very dangerous, can also cause kidney damage, terrible disease, and very hard to treat. Beta thalassemia is a problem in a slightly different location. It causes a severe form of anemia, and people who have this will often need blood transfusion. So there's a group working on beta thalassemia and sickle cell, and another group working on just sickle cell. Last year, the European Union actually approved a gene therapy called Zynteglo to treat beta thalassemia. This is where we get to that AstraZeneca vaccine. This approach uses a virus to actually shuttle a functioning copy of the beta globulin gene into blood-producing cells. But the trouble with this is that the blood-producing cells only last a certain amount of time. If you can get them into the stem cells, then you can do a better job. But it's looking at duration. How long does it stay in the stem cells? is it going to persist is an open question because we don't have the long-term data on this. The RNA approach, therefore, takes using a virus to put RNA, human RNA, into a cell. The CRISPR approach is using a small molecular machine that was originally invented, if you could use that word, by bacteria, as part of their immune system, and literally going down to the DNA level, matching to a particular sequence, and cutting out that DNA and possibly inserting other DNA. It depends on how you program your CRISPR. But this thing is buildable and programmable and a lot easier to grow than a virus. Both studies looking at the sickle cell went after a gene region called BCL11A. What they were seeking to do is to turn off the turning off of fetal hemoglobin. That's what that gene does. So let's go back to when you're in utero, all right? You're living off essentially your mom's venous blood. That blood that's coming to you has very low oxygen. Your mom's body has already used up a lot of the oxygen. So this is blood that you have to get it to release all of its oxygen, whatever it's remaining. And hemoglobin ordinarily doesn't do that. Fetal hemoglobin does. So fetal hemoglobin, if you could turn that back on, then it could replace the defective beta chain, and you would not get the sickling. And this does actually work and has been done in humans, and that's why I'm so excited about this. The other approach, using a viral vector, used a snippet of RNA that switches off the expression of this BCL11A gene. So you can either disable it with CRISPR, or you can switch it off with a piece of interfering RNA. Either one works. The CRISPR-Cas9 have got two participants in this latest report, but they've actually treated a total of 19 people. And the European group has treated six people with the beta thalassemia. In both cases, there's been a marked improvement in these living human beings. We're beginning to get to the point where we can actually repair DNA, not in cells, but actually in living, breathing people. And this is an extraordinarily exciting thing. But I want to take a moment and address one of the anti-vaccine memes, because I just talked about using a viral vector to change human DNA, using epigenetic techniques, which is not changing the DNA, but changing whether it's turned on or turned off. Now, that may seem like a little bit of a quibble because it is making a change. However, we methylate and adenylate and do all sorts of things to our DNA constantly with our behavior. So this is always going on anyway. We've just learned now how to go in there and tweak it to our specifications rather than the evolutionary specifications which are already programmed in. The key point here is that you're not using a viral RNA in the vaccines. They're using a viral vector, a different virus, and they're using it like a syringe. That virus has been disabled. It cannot reproduce. And it's dumping RNA for the spike protein of COVID-19 into the cell. And that RNA is then being translated from RNA into amino acid sequences. That's the spike protein. That's getting to the immune system, and the immune system is saying, oh, you're not human. You're not even friendly. I'm going to make antibodies against you. And that's how we're getting that particular vaccine. And there's a couple of more viral vectors out there, all sorts of different approaches being used. But the key point here is that you're not going to alter human DNA with a viral vaccine that containing viral RNA. It's just not going to happen. So I wanted to spend a moment talking about the latest advances on the subject of ketamine and depression. Ketamine is a drug that has recently been very exciting in the psychiatry community because we have about 30% of people that just don't respond to our antidepressants. And ketamine is approved for anesthesia, and it's also approved as a pain reliever. It was approved last year for the treatment of patients with major depression who are otherwise resistant to therapy. And it's very different from standard antidepressants. This is super important. It works within hours. So you can turn someone who is suicidal around within hours, and they're back to feeling normal. But we didn't really know how it worked. This latest study, just published in Nature and coming out of McGill University, the University of Montreal, and Carleton University, looked at ketamine and neuronal activity in mice. And using CRISPR, because, hey, it's a thing, they removed proteins from specific brain cells in the mice. They took away a set of proteins called the 4EBPs. When they are not in the neurons of the mice, ketamine doesn't work. What do the 4EBPs actually do? They're a molecular switch. So as we start talking about this molecular switch, okay, a classic one is estrogen. Estrogen's a hormone, right? It's made in the ovaries, made in the adrenal glands, leaves those, travels in the bloodstream. That's what makes it a hormone. Goes to the cell, soaks right in because it's lipid soluble, goes right through the cell wall, goes right into the nucleus, and goes and sits in a place on the DNA, multiple places on the DNA. These are called gene suites. They're a bunch of functional genes that code for proteins that do things. Some of them turn on, for example, secondary sexual characteristics like breast development, etc. And estrogen is the master switch for a whole lot of that. So you could think of these 4EBPs as being switches that affect two different types of neurons, incitatory and inhibitory. Turns out that ketamine's effect on these is essentially to increase the activity of the excitatory neurons, kind of perk you up a little bit in certain parts of the brain, and inhibit things which, among other things, inhibit the excitatory neurons. So the inhibitory neurons. And so it's just like you were seeing, as I think about this, the old graphic equalizer that used to be in my husband's office, and it had, you know, the different frequency ranges. And if you wanted more bass, you kicked up the ones on the left. And if you wanted more treble, you kicked up the ones on the right. Imagine that you were doing that with brain cells, taking certain neurons, making them a little brighter, a little more dominant in the overall symphony of thought. That's pretty much exactly what ketamine's doing, and it's doing it really quickly, unlike the antidepressants that we're stuck with, like Prozac and its friends, which take weeks, sometimes even months, to start to have an effect. And then, you know, you're 2 months down the road before you realize that it's not working, and try another drug. Well, now we have some better solutions than just trying another drug. And let's stay on drugs for just another moment. I loved this study. It was looking at driving performance, trying to be really scientific, and looking at pot, both CBD and cannabidiol, and looking at driving performance. And so we're going to spend a little time talking about the brilliant experimental design here. They used as the measure, whenever you set up an experiment, it's like, okay, what am I going to measure? Am I going to measure the speed the plant grows, or how tall the plant gets, or am I going to measure how much fruit the plant does, or the thickness of the stem, or its resistance to whatever? So you get the idea. You have to pick what you're going to measure, and whatever it is, it better be something you've got a good tool for measuring. So they used lane weaving for this study. And the way it worked, it's called the standard deviation of lateral position. It was a 100-kilometer drive, and they did it in either 40 minutes after vaping or 240 minutes after vaping. They also calibrated it for alcohol consumption. So they did, with the same people, they gave them enough alcohol to get them to a 0.02% alcohol. And then they measured how much lane weaving they got relative to placebo. So they had a benchmark for this in these individuals. Then they did it for 0.05. So at 0.02, you got an increase of 1 centimeter. And at 0.05, which is still legal, I think it might even be legal in the Netherlands, and Europe's stricter than we are, it increased to 2.4. So a substantial increase in lane weaving. They had 26 people, and they gave them either a CBD-dominant cannabis, a THC-dominant cannabis, or a THC-CBD equivalent cannabis, so I guess equal proportions, and a placebo cannabis. And they looked at them at 40 to 100 minutes following consumption. They were given a dose of 13.75 milligrams. Before I tell you the results, I want to ask, does anybody out there, maybe a grower or somebody who's in marijuana production, now that it's legal and you can kind of call in, please tell me, what does that amount to in terms of a dose? Is that like one good lungful of a standard vape concentration? What's the range of dose concentrations? I mean, how much would you have to smoke to get the 13.75? Because I don't know what this is. Now, in the case of the placebo cannabis, this was just a vape pen that only had vehicle. So I should have clarified that. So it looked the same, acted the same, because you can talk yourself into feeling high. There's no doubt about that. But they were really trying to be scientific here. What they found was that it really made a difference, okay? For the THC-dominant cannabis, they got a 2.33, so roughly the same as having a blood alcohol, 0.05. They got about the same thing, actually a little bit worse with the THC-CBD equal cannabis. And that actually makes sense, because one of the things that CBD does, interestingly enough, is slow down the breakdown in the brain of THC. So essentially, you're going to get an augmented effect with a combo product, which is, you know, a little counterintuitive, but absolutely true. Now, the CBD-dominant cannabis had no effect on the lane deviation. So it was actually a little bit better, but you figure the people may have noticed perhaps a little effect. They may have known that they needed to slow down. Maybe they drove a little bit slower. They did not control for speed, just lane deviation. Now, when you got up to 240 to 300 minutes, so call it 4 to 5 hours, there was basically no difference between the groups and the placebo. It was fine. So we've got now from this study some interesting information. Wait 6 hours before you drive. If you've smoked, that would be how you would keep things completely safe. And I think that's probably a really good idea. We do know that there are more car accidents. This is statistical. So more car accidents in people who are driving under the influence of both alcohol and marijuana. And we now have a study that kind of gives you a calibration. I love the blood alcohol calibration, and I'm surprised at how impaired people were. But of course, whenever you're doing anything, whether it's alcohol or THC, your insight into whether you're impaired or not is clearly one of the first things to get impaired. Let's do one about the microbiome. I cannot resist doing something with the microbiome every show. And fortunately, there's a great deal of fodder, if you'll pardon a very bad pun, in the scientific literature at the moment. So birth by cesarean section has been shown to be very detrimental to normal gut microbiota development. During birth by C-section, infants are not exposed to maternal fecal microbes, right? They're bypassing the vagina, which is full of bacteria. Furthermore, most women actually poop when they're giving birth, and that's actually a really good thing because the baby gets smeared, and then you have to wipe the baby off. But meanwhile, the baby has an exposure, which is awesome because we're seeding that important bacterial family that's adapted itself to mom into the baby. So a recent study done in Helsinki wanted to see whether intestinal microbiota development could be restored in term C-section infants by postnatally giving them orally delivered maternal fecal micro biota transplantation. It was published in Cell a few months ago in October. They took the fecal microbiota transplantation using mom's own fecal samples, and they screened them. And they had seven pathogen-free samples, so these were the ones that they used in the study. And all seven of those infants received the fecal microbiota. Women who had, you know, bad bacteria, we didn't give it to their infants. They were monitored for 3 months, and then at the end of the 3 months, they compared it to untreated C-section babies and vaginally born infants. The gut microbiota very quickly matched that of the vaginally born infants. It did not resemble that of the untreated C-section. So this is very good data. I think we're at a point where if I'm going to be all natural, I would run a screen on a woman for organisms that would be dangerous to the baby when she started labor. And if there was a problem, certainly if it was a scheduled C-section, that's easy. But every now and then, you think you're going to have a fine delivery and something, you know, goes sideways. So it would be nice to have that before, so that you would know that it would be okay to just swab mom's rectum and put that in the baby's mouth. That's pretty much what happens during birth. We'd be replicating something that already happens in nature. And it's a weird idea. It's going to take a while for medicine to get its mind around it. But let me tell you, the number of allergies, and as far as that goes, the tendency of a child to have asthma and allergies, you could see statistically that if you were born by C-section, that risk is much, much greater. And we now know how to undo it. And honestly, I think we should. Starting with an email from Joyce in Piedmont. Subject, EMDR for cognitive therapy. Dear Dr. Dawn, I'm a longtime listener. You're amazing and I've learned so much from you and improved my health with all your excellent advice. On your December 2nd, also called December 9th, podcast, you mentioned cognitive therapy. I had EMDR after an auto accident in 2011. It helped me accept my, quote, new body and was incredibly helpful for having me move on and stop grieving for my old body. I had never heard cognitive therapy and how it works described so well until your podcast. I didn't know if you wanted to mention EMDR for those listeners looking for that type of therapy. Well, yes, of course I do. I do want to start out just by mentioning our convention. When you go to our program, you'll see two dates. One is the date of broadcast, and then usually 5 or 6 days later is the date that we post it to the internet. So you're looking at our processing. Before we talk about EMDR, I want to talk about something called polyvagal theory. You've heard of fight or flight, and you've heard of deer in the headlights, and you've heard of rest and digest. So the first one is pretty self-explanatory. Adrenaline, fight or flight, turns off the front end of your brain. You have reflex responses. You're responding emotionally, and you have sort of very stereotypical simple decision tree. You either get out of there if that looks doable, or you prepare to attack if that looks doable. And it's pretty automatic, and you don't have much to do with it. You've also had the experience of deer in the headlights. I think most classically, I can recall several automobile accidents I've had. Nothing serious, thank God. But during the moment of the inevitability of the accident, there's a very interesting cognitive change that one experiences. A sort of calmness and also almost a paralysis falls on you. Think about videos. I saw a video this morning on Pinterest of someone picking up a squirrel that was paralyzed with fear. And in fact, we had that experience ourselves with a young fox some years ago here on our land. The animal just won't move. It holds very, very still, and it is terrified. We've all had that paralysis. That's called the dorsal vagal response. And then there's the ventral vagal response. And the dorsal and ventral refer to the location of the nerve roots, or rather the soma, which is the cell body of the nerve, as it comes out of the base of the brain. The dorsal vagals cause you to go into a paralysis. The ventral vagals are what cause you to relax. They're what drop you out of fight or flight and calm you down. They're what turn on your digestive system and let down of your milk if you're lactating, and all sorts of other things that can really only take place in a safe environment. So, like birth, for that matter, because if you kick fight or flight into gear in a woman who is in labor, you can shut down labor. And some of the early therapies for that included drugs that actually kicked up fight or flight. They didn't kick it up in the brain. They kicked it up in the bloodstream, speeded up the heart, but fooled the uterus into thinking that there was a predator around and it better stop laboring for the moment. I wanted you to have that background. Now let's talk about EMDR. This is a type of therapy where a person is usually guided in EMDR to move their eyes back and forth. In the article I discussed on the second broadcast show, they were using tapping, but it's really the same thing. I think they're both affecting the same reflex reset button in the base of the brain. Now, the right and left hemispheres of our brain are connected by something called the corpus callosum. And lots of things, like sensory input from the right and left side of the body, are going to be processed on both sides of the brain. There's sort of a communication. Literally, the nerves that you touch are on the right side, but the place where you feel it is on the left side. So it has to cross the brain, and it does that through the corpus callosum, causing neuronal impulses, I should say, to move back and forth, across the corpus callosum while thinking about the thing that traumatized you, somehow disconnects the emotional overlay, the emotional imprinting of the trauma. The people are able to let go of their fear. They're able to begin to process using those frontal higher centers that were offline during the trauma itself, because you just don't process stuff then. Where I see EMDR as being really, really useful is in post-trauma. So if you have a bad accident, if you're injured, the first thing that I recommend doing is getting some Inderol, which is a sympathetic blocking agent. In other words, it blocks fight or flight in your heart. And low doses of Inderol have been shown in disasters to drastically reduce the probability that the individual is going to get PTSD. And by the way, there's a genetic predisposition to PTSD. If you have family members, particularly more than one family member with it, you might want to go looking in your DNA to see if you've got it too, and maybe have your, just in case you are horribly injured, you can be sure that you remember to ask for those
beta blockers.
You might be able to avoid that tendency. But if it did happen to you and you did develop post-traumatic stress, imagine using EMDR or tapping in order to reprogram and reset your brain so that you quit being in the iterative loop of stimulus, fear, paralysis, stimulus, fear, paralysis, acting out, loss of sleep, and all of the things that come with the syndrome that we now call PTSD. But by the way, it's always been a thing. And back in World War I, where there was a lot of it, they called it shell shock. I just wanted to take Joyce's email. I've got more emails for you in just a moment. But this article just dovetails so beautifully with it. It's about mindfulness. One of the easiest ways to raise that ventral vagal tone, the rest and digest, is deep breathing. When you breathe slowly, about 5 to 7 times per minute, you actually stimulate the vagus nerve, and it releases chemicals in the brain, and it releases chemicals in the bloodstream, and there are nerves that go directly to the blood vessels, and they release acetylcholine, and it leads to relaxation of the circular muscles around the blood vessels. Slow, deep breathing lowers blood pressure. There's a pilot randomized trial going on right now, and they're going to do deep breathing, lowering blood pressure in a controlled situation. I'm not sure how they're going to do the control, but what they're looking for is sustained decreases in blood pressure and also lowering of the rate of the development of coronary artery disease, one of the biggest killers in the world and climbing all the time. So let's just learn to breathe deeply and slowly. There's a video on my website that links to stress reduction in the time of COVID. There are breathing exercises on that video. It's a YouTube video, so you can just link to it. I highly recommend that or other slow-paced breathing. There's actually an FDA-approved device called Respirate, which is a little strain gauge that you put on your chest, and all it does is tell you to breathe in, give you a count, tell you to breathe out through a set of headphones. You can probably find similar apps online now that everyone and his cousin Al has a smartphone. We no longer have to have dedicated devices for this sort of thing. But I don't think that the smartphones have yet figured out how to measure your chest expansion. And one of the key ways to get this to work is to breathe from the belly. If you're using your diaphragm as you breathe rather than your upper chest muscles, you get much better results. All right, next email comes from Pat in Santa Cruz, a regular listener and always asks such intelligent questions. Dear Dr. Don, on cold mornings when I'm outside wearing a mask, my breath condenses on the inside of the mask and the mask gets a little bit damp. Most of the articles I've found that might deal with this seem to be aimed at healthcare workers and say you shouldn't reuse mask. I think that you were talking about ways to sterilize masks, but I'm wondering about the dampness. I've heard that wetness destroys some of the capabilities of the mask. I'm talking about the N95 and surgical masks, not necessarily cloth ones. Thank you for any elucidation you can provide, and as always, for your show. So let me first address fabric, even though this wasn't something Pat asked. Recent study was published, it was JAMA, but I will have to go hunt it up to tell you. But it was looking at best practices for masks if they are fabric. So there's a couple of things. It's great if they have a little insertable filter. That actually seems to help. Three layers is better than two. And two different fabrics is better than one. So if you had, for example, a layer that was very finely woven silk and another layer that was cotton and a third layer that was flannel, maybe against the inside of your face, that might be a really good structure for a fabric mask. Those, of course, can be washed and they can be put in the dryer. And for either a surgical mask or a fabric mask, I think Pat's problem could be helped by just putting a couple layers of folded Kleenex or a paper towel inside the mask, and that would act to absorb some of the condensation such that the business part of the surgical mask, which is something called blow melt, I'm thinking it's probably melted plastic that's blown through some sort of machine, given the name, and you get this sort of mesh-like structure that traps, it has lots of nooks and crannies, kind of Swiss cheesy, but many, many more holes than that, and it traps viruses and small particles. It doesn't let them get through. So the problem with the melt-blown is that once it gets wet, number one, a wet mask, bacteria can wick through the mask, so you may not have as good protection against bacteria, and that's primarily where these studies come from. We're extrapolating that probably that means viruses will also get through, because part of the way that masks kill viruses is by drying them out. So if they're wet, they're not going to do that. You can re-sterilize masks, surgical masks, and restore N95s. That had to be done back in the spring. And because the N95s are fairly expensive, if a person is just using them not in the setting where there's a known positive case, but where you're doing social distancing, but you're very vulnerable, perhaps you're older, you have other diseases, so you're bothering to buy that N95, you don't need to spend $10 a day. You can actually get rid of the virus and the bacteria and the odor that the mask will take if you reuse it, by putting it over warm but not boiling water, and the temperature needs to be between 150 and 170 Fahrenheit. So you can use a cooking thermometer and get the water not simmering, get it even, get it at steady state, make sure it's staying at that temperature with the lid on, and then you're going to put the mask on a steamer rack, like a vegetable steamer, and cook it at 150 to 170 Fahrenheit for about 20 minutes. And that will pretty much restore the mask for these purposes. You know, it's going to be pretty good unless you boil it. And if it does boil, you've ruined the mask. What happens with surgical masks and the N95s at that point is if they get wet enough, and steam will do it, then that melt-blown expands and basically becomes unbreathable. It's not, you're not going to be able to get enough air, so you'll be suffocating yourself trying to suck air in and probably leaking unscreened air around the edges of the mask as you try not to die. You'll know when your N95 mask has become saturated because it's really hard to breathe through them, and that's when you have to say goodbye and regretfully let it go. Our next email comes from Troy in Pacific Grove. Hi, Dr. Don. What insights do you have about managing floaters? I'm 69 years of age with no previous eye issues, but last Friday I noticed a small loss of vision in my left eye, like losing a few pixels if I were a camera. It's as though a small particle or thread was dangling in front of my eye, blocking my vision. Fortunately, I was able to get examined by an ophthalmologist a few days later. He diagnosed that I had a floater, which he described as caused by the hardening and shrinking of the gelatin fluid in the eye as one ages, as it pulls away from the retina and the separation casts shadows. In some cases, this can cause the retina to pull away as well. This is true. I have had that phenomenon, personally. My eye doctor is just monitoring, and I'll go back in a month to be re-examined. So, will the floaters heal? Or will I just need to adapt to having small blobs floating in front of me? Well, Troy, sometimes the floaters will actually, once you've released the gel inside your eye and it is now spinning within your eye, at that point, if you're lucky, it will rotate out of the primary visual axis. And that can and does happen. But you also have neurological adaptation. So typically what happens is that your brain learns to edit out the floaters, and they only are really noticeable in certain circumstances, very bright light and a white wall or something like that, where they cast a real substantial shadow. And for the most part, people learn to live with them. Now, I want to point out, if you get a sudden shower of floaters, where there's like 20 or 30 of them, like a swarm of mosquitoes or something, that's an eye emergency, because at that point, you may actually have torn the retina. As long as the gel releases slowly and gradually, it doesn't tear the retina. But if there's a sudden blow to the head or something like that, it can actually rip the retina loose, and you can start to get the fluid under. This is called the vitreous material, by the way. And if the vitriol starts to get underneath the retina, it'll start pulling the retina away. And that is a eye emergency. You can lose vision substantially in the eye forever if you don't recognize that and get help immediately. And the treatment for that one is surgical. Second question from Troy, is there anything nutrition-wise I might take to improve the fluid gel in my eye to prevent or slow down any further damage? There was nothing in Google Scholar about nutrition or drugs. And given the nature of the process and the fact that it's really a natural result of the senescence and breakdown of a biological material, I don't think so. However, you might be able to improve your eye and possibly reduce the shrinkage of the gel by increasing blood flow to the eyeball. And that you could do with acupuncture. There are several studies demonstrating that an acupuncture therapeutic protocol called the liver cerebral pathway will actually increase blood flow to the eye. So that might be a worthwhile thing to consider, not inexpensive, I had when my vitreous detached and I tore a little hole in my retina, I had that repaired with a laser, and I lined up with a local acupuncturist some treatments. And what I noticed subjectively, and hey, there's no placebo here, so it could have been my imagination, is that I had an increased clarity in my poor old myopic eyeballs. I wouldn't say they were sharper. It was more like the contrast was higher. And that lasted for several days after the treatment, and I don't think it was my imagination. And I did it just to improve healing because I just had a surgical procedure and seemed like it was a good idea. Healed up just fine. And so far, so good. Go on to our next emailer. This is Amy in Aptos. And Amy writes, smell and diet. Dear Dr. Don, I was interested in the smell question in December. Just for those of you who missed that one, a person changed her diet over to paleo and her vegetarian, nasally sensitive husband was having trouble being in the room with her. One thing I did not hear you address directly is the bacterial mix in your gut. The woman with the question ate a lot of fermented foods for probiotic function. I have sensitive smell too. I notice a change in my smell, I think she means her odor, that I find a bit disturbing if I am taking foods high in probiotics or probiotic supplements. I don't like the smell. I believe I'm actually smelling the bacteria in my gut. My husband doesn't notice a thing. Well, I'm wondering, first of all, Amy, where are you smelling it? Because we can measure a lot of chemicals in the breath that are clearly coming from our gut bacteria. They are not coming from us because we don't physiologically process things that way. So we know that it goes from essentially your colon and your intestines into your bloodstream, into your lungs, and gets exhaled. So if it's in the air coming, you know, out of your mouth, and the simplest way to check that is to lick the back of your hand and sniff real quick and see if that's the smell that we're talking about. Is it your armpits? In which case, I'd be more interested in whether it could have something to do with a change in your body flora. And I can certainly see a possibility, although I was unable to find anything in the literature, that you could be sweating out certain compounds that are made by your gut bacteria, just like these ones that you're exhaled. We can find a whole bunch of them in urine. In fact, we do something called organic acid testing in order to figure out whether you have certain kinds of bacteria, very helpful, for example, for finding fungi and yeast, because these are compounds that are only made by the metabolism of the fungi, and so it wouldn't be there except if you had fungi in your gut. But I also wonder about choline-containing foods. I came across, in my search for answers to your question, a hereditary condition called trimethylaminuria. And in this situation, people will get a mild garbagey odor intermittently in their skin. And it comes from eating foods that are high in choline. So, Amy, what I want to suggest is go look up the food list of foods high in choline and see if that correlates with the dietary changes that you mentioned. If you are taking foods high in probiotics or prebiotics, and I'm wondering whether some of the prebiotics couldn't have that property, you may have a genetic propensity to do that, and you might, so avoiding choline containing foods, if that looks plausible after you've looked at the list, might be a way to test this. It's truly a unique question, Amy, and I thank you very much for asking it. That is part of what makes this program so fun for me and why I keep doing it, is the opportunity to interact with people on these very, very interesting questions that they come up with. So we're going to move now to a article about a new potentially useful device for prostate hyperplasia. This is a disease that affects the quality of life of many men. And Unfortunately, just like the lens, we get cataracts because the lens of our eye never stops growing. Well, the prostate never stops growing either. And eventually it starts to get crowded down there and the urethra gets squeezed. Sometimes, but without the prostate even being all that big on the outside, it's like a donut where the inside of the donut hole is growing, but the outside really hasn't started to grow yet. There's a new therapy. It's been out for a few years now. I think it's been out for about 5 years, but that's the longest follow-up we've got. So I want to start by saying that this is relatively new. It's called prosthetic urethral lift. It's becoming, fashionable is not the right word. It's becoming popular for a couple of reasons. One of which is it's an outpatient procedure. Another one is it's not very invasive and you don't have damage to the nerves, no chance of ejaculatory or erectile dysfunction, unlike what you might see if you have the medical procedure called a transurethral resection of the prostate, where that occasionally happens afterwards. That's obviously trading one bad quality of life issue for another. So this was a meta-analysis looking at five different studies, and they looked at two-year follow-up of these five different studies. So how does this work? They're basically two implants that go on either side. The approach is through the urethra. Think of them like staples. Essentially, if you can imagine stretching the prostate with a couple of staples down there to the inside of the pelvis, you open up the hole around the urethra, and it's pretty good. There's a 35-point international prostate scale. This improves it by about 10 points, and this is across many different studies that were looked at. The longest follow-up study that was done was looking at another question, which is surgical reintervention. In other words, how much of the time did you have to go back in and get something else done? There were 11 studies. One of them went up to 5 years. They came out at around 6%. You know, these are different studies with different models, so this is called a meta-analysis. Essentially, what we've got here is a procedure, and the trade name in the United States for this is UroLift, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone else comes up with another product that does the same thing. This is going to proliferate. It seems to me that having looked this up for another patient and then coming across this study, I thought, you know, I really think I'm going to put this out as something that gets a thumbs up for people who are really suffering. Tried the saw palmetto, you've tried the nettle, you've maybe tried the Flomax, the Tamulosin, maybe you've even gone on the Proscar for this, but you're still not getting the relief you need and you're not really feeling like you want to do surgery. This might be a good compromise move, and I know I hear so many questions about this in my practice. I figure this is just a way to reach a larger group of people and suggest they look into this. By the way, I have no advertisers. This is not something that anybody asked me to do, and I don't accept support for any commercial entities. So that's just how we roll here at Ask Dr. Dawn, and I hope you'll join me next week. In the meantime, so important. Social distance, wear your mask, stay safe, my friends. I'll be back next week. And until then, stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.